Christchurch Hawthorne, our mission is to renew the city by multiplying Christ-like disciples. Teaching the Bible is a critical way we do that. As you listen to this sermon, we pray that God will use it to equip you to go out and live like Jesus, to live for Jesus, and to bring the renewing love of Jesus to the city where you live.
Well, part of hopefully what's going to happen tonight is I'm not actually going to tell you a whole lot of stuff, but we're actually going to work some stuff out together as we look at what this guy Elihu has to say. We've had 30 chapters of Job so far. The friends and Job have been going backwards and forwards. The debate has been going on. Job hasn't backed down. They've come to a standstill. The debate has kind of reached a stalemate. Everyone's frustrated. Everyone's feeling unsettled. But if you think of the book of Job as a drama, it's a really good story. It's a good story. It's got highs and lows. It's got... And what happens here is that we're actually leading up to the big climax. Part of what makes a good story is building suspense up to that climax. And we've been leading up to the climax for some weeks. God is going to turn up. God is going to speak at the end. Nat's been kind of building up to that the whole way along. But Job's not in a good place. He's feeling even worse than before, if that were possible. It's like his friends are doing that kind of doing the armchair theology, but he's doing the wheelchair theology. He's not in a good place. He's been asking God to appear. He's been crying out for God to turn up, for God to speak, for God to respond to him. But instead, we get Elihu. We've got Elihu stuck in the middle between Job's plea and God actually rocking up. But what's part of what's going on here is that Elihu is actually building suspense. Elihu is actually part of why this is a good story. Elihu is part of why Job works as a story, as a drama. So we've got this speech, we've got this six-chapter-long speech or kind of collection of speeches. We've got to work out where it fits in. Some people have said it's like a taster of what's to come. God's going to turn up and Elihu sort of... Elihu starts to introduce what God is going to say. Elihu is kind of on the same page as God. I think Elihu does pave the way for God, but I think it's in a more negative way, perhaps. I want to suggest that Elihu is actually a false start. So, as we get into this, I encourage you to have your outline handy because that's where you can see where we're heading. And we're going to be reading bits of Elihu's speeches as we go along. Meek's going to come up and read to us along the way. Do we have a pile of Bibles at the back here? If you'd like to get your hands on a Bible in the same version as what Meek's going to be reading from, there is a small pile up the back, just so you know. So we've got some questions here about Elihu's speech, because as Nat was saying, this is really long. He goes on for a long time, but here's the weird thing: he gets ignored. No one else responds to Elihu. So there's some strange stuff going on here. So first question there: how is Elihu's speech different? Haven't the other people already covered everything? How's he different? Why is his speech ignored? Some people say, well, Elihu's not condemned. No one condemns what he says, so maybe he's saying something helpful. But that's not the issue. The issue is that he's not even mentioned. He's just ignored. No one responds to him at all. Why is that? Third question, why is Elihu's speech so long? He goes on and on. Surely he must have something good to say. Why doesn't God appear right away? We're looking for this resolution. Why hasn't God appeared? Why do we have to wait six chapters? And the last question there, how does Elihu's speech relate to God's speech? Well, just so we've got a snapshot of where we're heading, here are some initial answers to those questions. Elihu's speech, firstly, is different because it's kind of a gear change. The debate's over, everyone's looking for God to turn up. Elihu's speech, as I was saying, builds suspense. It anticipates God's arrival. Elihu's speech is ignored because, for one thing, his answers are inadequate. But again, he's setting the scene for God to turn up. He's building suspense. Elihu's speech is long because it's an anticlimax. It's a massive anticlimax that builds suspense with all this irony. God doesn't appear right away because, well, if he did, it might seem like Job has forced God's hand. Job's told God to turn up. God turns up. What's going on there? That mightn't work. And the last question, how does Elihu's speech relate to God's speech? What I want to suggest to you is that Elihu is actually a divine spoof. He's a parody of God. He's this extreme character. He's ridiculous. He's ironic. That's kind of who his character is. Well, I want to kind of pick up with that fourth question there, God's appearing. If you remember where Job finished up, this is at the end of chapter 31. Job concluded with a final desperate plea. This is what he had to say. He's crying out, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." He's crying out. It's building up tension. And the way that Job throws out this final challenge, it very much leaves the ball in God's court. He set it up. Job's words here set it up so that if God actually remains silent, if God doesn't say anything, Job will be vindicated. Job will be seen to have been right. But again, it would seem then that Job has actually forced God's hand. Job has compelled God to appear. Job somehow controls God's appearing. Well, no. But Job has questioned God. He's questioned God in a pretty upfront, full-on, aggressive sort of way. And, well, if God does respond, what's going to happen? Will Job present his case? Will he get zapped? What's going to happen? So we've got Job concluding here, building tension in the drama, building tension in a really big way. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. This situation is so torturous. It's just crying out for resolution. So what's going to happen next? Well, if you remember all the way back to the beginning of Job, we had the narrator speaking. We had this sort of voiceover introducing the whole story, and we get some more voiceover here at the beginning of chapter 32. It's a chunky little bit of voiceover. We haven't had this much voiceover since way back in like chapter 3. So we've got this interesting sort of pause or gear change kind of beginning to happen here. So we're going to have a look at this now as Mink comes up and reads that to us.
So these three men ceased to answer Job, because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job, because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends, because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than him. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, He burned with anger.
All right. So we've got Elihu. He's on the scene now. He's waited 30 chapters for this. What does he bring to the table? Well, I want you to notice two things here. Firstly, there's a word that's used three times to describe him. Angry. Angry. This guy is angry. And there's another word used as well. He is young. Elihu is a young, angry guy. Well, maybe this doesn't give us a whole lot to go on at this point, but it does say something about the tone of Elihu's speech. It doesn't sound like a serene, calm voice. This guy is head up. This guy's in a bit of a mood. He's head up about things. So we're already getting a feel for the tone of what's to come. Okay, so let's start listening to Elihu's speech. All the other guys have had their say. Elihu is, well, hopefully, maybe, going to bring something new. As you listen to Meek read this next bit from near the beginning of Elihu's speech, have a listen out for what this guy's character is like. We've heard a bit about the tone, but what's his character like? Meek.
Therefore I say, listen to me. Let me also declare my opinion. Behold, I waited for your words. I listened for your wise sayings while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words. Beware lest you say, we have found wisdom. God may vanquish him, not a man. He has not directed his words against me, and I will not answer him with your speeches. They are dismayed. They answer no more. They have not a word to say. And shall I wait because they do not speak? Because they stand there and answer no more? I also will answer with my share. I also will declare my opinion. For I am full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I might find relief. I must open my lips and answer.
That bit's from chapter 32, verses 10 to 20. All the bits that we're reading tonight, all the bits that Mink is reading, they are all listed there in your outline. So that's where we're going. As you heard Elihu speaking there, did you notice how much he talks himself up? Did you notice all the I language there? Listen to me, let me declare. I will not answer him with your speeches. I also will answer. I also will declare. I am full of words. I must speak. I must open my lips. So this Elihu guy he's kind of focused on himself to the point of repetition. He spends the whole first chapter of his speech just talking about himself, just introducing himself. And as he builds himself up here, it's like he's actually inflating. This is actually humorous. Listen to this. I'm full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. He's swelling up. He's inflating. He's really over the top. And he's kind of a windbag. And this is partly why Elihu's speeches are so long. He just won't shut up. He just keeps going. He's long-winded. So we've got a sense now of Elihu's tone. He's angry and he's young. And we've got a sense of his character as well. He's self-focused. He's repetitive. He's a windbag. Okay. But what is Elihu doing? What's he on about? What does he actually want to say? And as we go on, we're going to see that it's not just Elihu's tone and character that are a bit dodgy. It's actually the claims that he makes as well. What he's doing, what he begins to do, is set himself up as the true sage, the true wise man. But what we're going to see is that He's actually like a fake sage. He's actually a parody of a sage. His claims sound good on the surface, but they're actually mistaken and misplaced. Okay, so we're going to begin to hear now from further on in Elihu's speech. The passages I've got down here, they're not neat divisions, but hopefully they're snapshots that kind of give you a sense of what he's saying. And before we get to chapter 34, which is the next bit that Minka's going to read, we've got Elihu acting like he wants to help Job. So in chapter 33, we haven't read from chapter 33, but in chapter 33 he says, I want to vindicate you, Job. And he spends half of chapter 33 talking about how a sufferer can repent and can turn back to God and can learn to be upright. As if he's saying, Job, you could turn around, you could repent, you could have everything fixed up with God. But listen to chapter 34, Mink.
For Job has said, I am in the right, and God has taken away my right. In spite of my right, I am counted a liar. My wound is incurable, even though I am without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinks up scoffing like water, who travels in the company with evildoers and walks with wicked men? For he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God. Therefore, hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of a man, he will repay him, and according to his ways, he will make it before him. Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. Who gave him charge over the earth, and who laid on him the whole world? If he should set his heart to it and gathers to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust.
Okay, so although Elihu has begun by saying, Job, I'm on your side, buddy, almost. He's been talking about himself as an advocate for Job, but did you see what happened here? He's actually just assumed the same thing as all the other friends. Look at verse 7 there. What man is like Job, who drinks up scoffing like water, who travels in company with evildoers and walks with wicked men? He's claiming that Job's a sinner. Job's done wrong. Job, you've fallen down. You've been hanging out with the wrong people. You've done wrong. You're a sinner. Now, if you've been here for, well, probably any of the last 10 weeks, you'll know that Elihu's kind of losing us here. He's kind of losing his audience. Because what do we know about Job? What did it say three times in the introduction? Job is blameless and upright. Job is blameless and upright. The introduction made a point of saying that three times. But Elihu has just pronounced Job guilty. And later on in this chapter, he kind of slams the nail in the coffin. He says, for God has no need to consider a man further, that he should go before God in judgment. As if to say, Job, you might as well own up to it because God has already passed judgment on you. There's no need for there to be any more talk. You've been judged. And while this is going on, of course, we've got Elihu saying that he himself is in the right. So this is getting really hard to take. One guy put it this way. I like this. He said, dealing with good poetry is hard and exhilarating. Dealing with Elihu is just hard. But listen to the next reading because it actually gets worse. We're going to hear from chapter 35 now, Mink.
Because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call out for help because the arm of the mighty. But none says, where is God my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens. There they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him, and that you are waiting for him. And now, because his anger does not punish, and he does not take much note of transgression, Job opens up his mouth with empty talk. He multiplies words without knowledge. And Elihu continued and said, "Bear with me a little, and I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar, and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you."
Yeah, well, ouch. "I will get my knowledge from afar. Truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Elihu's just spent the whole of chapter 32 introducing himself, and here he is again talking about how great he is, about how he's the real deal. We've looked a bit at Elihu's first claim that Job is wrong. Now we're looking at the second one. Elihu's claiming that God is right. This is where Elihu's a bit different to the other friends. He really goes into bat for God. Did you hear that there verse 2 there of chapter 36, verse 2. "I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker." Okay. So Elihu's not just claiming that he is the true sage. He's actually setting himself up as the mouthpiece of God. He's acting like he is the divine telephone line. It's like he's saying, "God is right because I'm right. I'm on God's side. I'm the voice of God. Listen to me." It's this kind of thing. Now, of course, all the time in the Old Testament, you've got prophets turning up and claiming to speak for God. But the true prophets in the Old Testament are God-given. Their qualifications come from God. But all that's going on here is that Elihu's speaking for himself. He's a self-appointed prophet. He's not a God-appointed prophet. And so he's got this claim here. This is in, have a look at verse 12. He's claiming that God doesn't respond to the wicked. He says, "There they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him, and you are waiting for him." And he goes on. God doesn't respond to the wicked, Job. Why the heck would he respond to you? He's setting it up so that God is right. Wicked people don't get a response. God is always right. And verse 13 there, "Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it." He's set it up so that he's not just claiming that God is right, but that God is unimpeachable, unquestionable almost. He's stacking the deck so that no matter what Job says, God is right. End of story. There's nothing more to be said. But look what else is going on here. Elihu is speaking for God, like we were saying. His name, Elihu, actually means "He is my God." He is my God. So, in Job the drama, Job the story, think of where this guy kind of fits in. Imagine if Job is a play, like at the theatre. And it's like the next character rocks up wearing this T-shirt that says, "The Voice of God," and he kind of runs on stage, "Hey, fellas, 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 listen to me." This ironic, extreme, ridiculous sort of character, the voice of God. That's kind of what's going on here with Elihu. You know, there is actually a musical of the Book of Job that I found the other day. It's absolutely hilarious. Although Elihu doesn't really get much of a look in there, he is excluded for reasons of pacing, much to his disgust. So, Elihu is claiming to speak for God. He's claiming that God is right. At this point, it's worth asking the question, if this is true, if Elihu is actually speaking for God, why are God's speeches so different to what Elihu has to say? More to the point, actually, why does God even need to speak at all? Now, that's the question. If Elihu is actually speaking for God, why would God need to bother turning up at all? Well, for the answer to that question, come back next week to hear what Tammy has to say about God's speeches. But we've got Elihu getting all defensive. He's acting like it's all up to him to defend God. He's working really hard. And let's look now at Elihu's third claim, because he's acting like he knows God better than God knows himself. Okay, so let's hear from Mink again from chapter 37.
"Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command upon them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind, can you, like him, spread out the skies hard as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. Shall it be told him that I would speak? Did a man ever wish that he would be swallowed up? And now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies. When the wind has passed and cleared them, out of the north comes golden splendor. God is clothed with awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power. Justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said...
Okay. So remember that Elihu has already pronounced judgment on Job, and he's claimed that God is in the right. God's not going to respond to the wicked, Job. That was chapter 34, chapter 35. Here, Elihu's claiming that God won't appear. God can't even appear. Look at his final words there. "The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." He's saying, Job, God is awesome and he's not listening to you. He's set it up so that there's no way God could possibly appear. He's speaking for God. He's got it all worked out. Don't worry about God. He's not going to turn up. So Elihu's set it up so that God is like this unimpeachable superpower who's so great and so mighty that he's scarcely even mindful of Job's existence at all. God won't appear to you, Job. See how it's building suspense as well? Now, maybe at this point, maybe Elihu is right. God hasn't appeared yet. Maybe he's right. But in mere moments, God does appear. Elihu could be right that Job is wrong and that God is right. He could be quite right about that. But when God actually rocks up in just a few moments, that kind of brings into question everything that Elihu has said, doesn't it? Actually, Elihu has got God totally wrong. So when God appears in the next chapter speaking from the storm, the very fact that he appears overrides everything that Elihu has said and cancels it out. So we've got Elihu here. It's not just building suspense, but even as Elihu denies God's appearance and says, it's not going to happen, God's not going to appear. Why would God want to appear to you, Job? He's actually paving the way for that. He's actually preparing the way for God to appear, quite unknown to him, apparently. Okay, so we've got Elihu's three claims there. He claims that Job is wrong, that God is right, that God won't appear. But what we've been seeing is that each of these claims is ridiculously mistaken or misplaced. So we've got this guy who's an extreme character. He's ridiculous. He's ironic. He's not happy with the situation. He thinks it's all up to him to defend God. And for us as Christians, we do believe in defending our faith, absolutely, but Elihu acts as if it's his sole responsibility. It all rests on his shoulders, as if God isn't actually big enough to stand up for himself. So you can see that Elihu's speech, it's not really a continuation of the debate at all. It's kind of a new low, even as it builds suspense. So we've got these six chapters as a massive, a bloated anti-climax, paving the way for God. It's building suspense through irony. That's kind of what's going on. So Elihu is like a spoof of God. Again, in the drama of Job, in Job as a story, Elihu is kind of like the halftime entertainment. We get to the end of the debate. It's a stalemate. Everyone's sort of, you know, shuffling their feet and going, oh, I wonder what's going to happen next. And then this guy comes on almost like a clown for a bit of, yeah, a bit of laughter. There is humor going on here in these speeches. We've got a bit of a sense of that. Okay, well, we're moving now to the final point there, number four, God with us. Okay, so Elihu's speech is a lesson in how not to respond to suffering. Remember how Elihu responded to Job? He claimed that Job is wrong, that God is right, that God won't appear. Again, there's an extent to which Elihu is right. God is right, we take it. But here the problem isn't so much the claim that Elihu's making, but the fact that he's claiming to speak on behalf of God. He's speaking into a situation where he has no insight at all, and yet he's claiming to speak for God. See, what sort of God does Elihu have? Because Elihu is so worried, he seems so pent up, that someone might question God. So Elihu feels the need to make this massive defense of God that goes on and on. Again, as if God is somehow so puny that he can't stand up for himself. So again, the problem is not that Elihu thinks God is right, but that Elihu thinks God needs Elihu to show that. So, in the end, Elihu's God is a small God, a little God, a God of neat boxes and pat answers. So, when we're responding to suffering around us, here's what we should not do. We should not go about it by attacking others and propping up God. Don't do it. Remember the bushfires, the most recent Victorian bushfires. There was a Christian pastor, Danny Nalia, who came out and said that those fires were God's judgment on the state of Victoria. I don't know if you remember that. Or you might remember back to September 11 in the United States. And Pat Robertson, a big-time Christian evangelist guy, came out and said, these attacks on America are God's judgment on America. You can see it there. God is right. You are wrong. And I want to say here, it's not particularly that that's unchristian or something. It's just stupid. It's foolish. It's foolish like Elihu. Why would you do that? Now, for us, maybe we're not as blatant and ridiculous about this as Elihu is. But let's ask ourselves the question, when we see suffering, how do we respond? How quickly do we ask ourselves, oh, is that person sinned? How quickly do we move to telling this person who's suffering about God's way? Well, the Bible says, how quickly do we move to that? How quickly do we move to pronouncing on the situation as if we have insight into it? I wonder what our impulses are there. I wonder what your impulses are there. And how quickly do we rush to defend God, to say that God is good? God is still good here somehow. God is in control here, don't you see? How quickly do we jump to do that? Now, that's a true thing, sure, but God doesn't need us to close ranks around him and defend him and prop him up, to rush into the gap, to rush to answer every question as if God's very existence depends on that. That's what Elihu is doing. That is where Elihu is wrong. And Elihu is kind of even more wrong today. He's not just a mini god or a fake god. He's also a fake Jesus. For us today, for us as Christians, we know that God has already acted in history. He's already acted to show us who he is in the person of Jesus. And Elihu is kind of acting like he's the incarnation of God. Do you see that? So, for us today, he's actually more ridiculous now than he was back then, because God has turned up. God has turned up now for us, not in a windstorm as for Job, but in the person of Jesus. God has turned up in history. God has incarnated himself amongst us. God has lived with us and experienced with us. So we might, today, we might not have God speaking to us directly out of the windstorm as Job did, but God has come near to us in Jesus. Jesus is God with skin on, as someone put it. When words run out and when answers fail, we meet God in Jesus. So as people responding to suffering around us, we don't need to be like Elihu. We don't need to be little Elihus running around trying to defend God, as if God needs us to do that. No, we respond by pointing to Jesus, by showing others who Jesus is. Because we know that God has arrived in Jesus. God has come near in Jesus. Not in a storm, but in a man. We don't necessarily have more answers than Elihu had. So we don't want to overstep the mark and end up looking foolish like Elihu. But we do have more to say about God. God has come near in the person of Jesus. God has turned up. And that makes all the difference.